counsel, ladies and gentlemen. The state will call for their first witness, Dr. Lindsay Thomas.
Dr. Thomas, if you feel comfortable doing so, we'd ask you to remove your mask. I will keep mine on.
I would love that. Thank you.
And let's begin by having you state your full name, spelling each of your names.
Lindsay, L-I-N-D-S-E-Y, Carol, C-A-R-O-L, Thomas, T-H-O-M-A-S.
Mr. Blackwell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Dr. Thomas.
Good morning.
Would you please tell us what kind of a doctor you are?
I'm a forensic pathologist.
What is a forensic pathologist?
Forensic pathology is that branch of pathology, which is the branch of medicine, where medicine and law overlap. So it could be anything with a medical and legal component. It could be toxicology. In some cases, it may involve living patients. But as I practice, and as most forensic pathologists practice, it involves what's called medico-legal death investigation.
Does it involve taking care of patients in the clinical sense?
Not living patients, no. A forensic pathologist may be consulted to help with the evaluation and interpretation of injuries in a living patient, but not in a treatment or clinical sense.
So most of your work then is done on deceased people?
Correct.
Any specific types of deaths?
Yes, the state statutes lists the types of deaths that have to be reported to the medical examiner, and briefly, they tend to be unnatural deaths, so accidents, suicides, homicides, unexpected deaths, potentially suspicious deaths, that type of category of death.
Do you get special training in how to determine the cause and manner of death?
Yes.
Tell us something about the special training you received.
Well, should I start back in medical school or just the end part?
Just the end part.
Okay. I did a fellowship in forensic pathology, which is a specified training program for doctors who want to be forensic pathologists to learn how to do medical legal death investigations and certify cause and manner of death.
So would you tell us what pathology is as a field of medicine?
Sure. Pathologists are sometimes considered the doctor's doctor because we don't directly treat patients, but we provide information to doctors who then do treat patients. So, for example, if you've ever been to a lab and had blood drawn, that goes to a laboratory that is run by a pathologist, a clinical pathologist. So, you know, blood count, chemistries, things like that. Or if you've ever known someone that had a biopsy and was diagnosed with cancer, that's the type of pathology that is done by an anatomic pathologist. So you look at tissue and under the microscope and make diagnoses.
Is a medical examiner a forensic pathologist?
In Minnesota, a medical examiner is a forensic pathologist who is appointed by the County Board of Commissioners to be that county's medical examiner.
So it's a public official?
Yes.
So when you talk about the medical legal investigations, is that sort of a fancy way of describing what forensic pathologists do?
Yes, it's what the medical examiner's office does. It's death investigations, again, where they're is a medical component, and there may be a legal component.
Is it different from, say, a death in a hospital?
Yes. So if someone dies in a hospital, those are usually deaths due to natural causes, and they may have a medical death investigation in the sense that a hospital pathologist might do an autopsy, but they wouldn't do the full scope of the medical legal death investigation because those are mostly due to natural diseases.
What does death investigation entail?
Well, the way a medical examiner's office performs a death investigation, I think a lot of people assume it's all about the autopsy, the physical examination of the body, and that's really just a tiny part of the death investigation. The death investigation really starts at the very beginning when a death is found, a person is found deceased, or the office is notified of the death. We, as medical examiners, want to know all about that person. What's their past medical history, social history, family history? So we will do whatever we need to do to get that kind of history. Then we want to know, well, what happened? What were their terminal events? What happened around the time of their death? Were they complaining of something? Were they interacting with someone? Were they driving? Were they using, you know, machinery, something like that? And then we'll look at the physical examination, and that part of the exam might include x-rays. It could include getting specimens for toxicology, for cultures, for all kinds of other laboratory tests, including looking at things under the microscope, little sections of each organ under the microscope. So that's the physical exam part. Then we'll look at the laboratory results. So that would be usually toxicology, but as I say, it could be blood cultures or more recently, it's probably been a lot of COVID testing, that kind of thing. And then look at the microscopic slides and then put all of that together with the history, the terminal events, the physical findings, the laboratory findings, and then that's how the medical examiner reaches a conclusion about the cause and manner of death.
So all of that goes into a death investigation?
Yes.
Do you sometimes interview people also as a part of it?
Yes, the investigators who go to the scene may talk to family members. We certainly will talk to medical providers to get someone's past medical history. We often will interview or talk with law enforcement officers if they were the people who responded. It could be paramedics, EMS, troopers. Just depends on the case.
I want to ask you about a phrase you use, terminal events.
Yes.
Could you explain to the jury what is a terminal event?
Sure. So when we're investigating a death as medical examiners, as I mentioned, we want to know as much as we can about this person leading up to their death, because that often, how they lived, will provide us information about how they died. When I'm talking about terminal events, I'm talking about what happened in the period of time around their death, leading up to their death. So, for example, he was out shoveling snow, he came in, clutched his chest, and fell over. That would be an example of a terminal event. Or we know someone was driving a car and went off the road. That would be what the terminal events were.
Do you also rely on training and expertise on how injuries occur?
Yes, as a forensic pathologist, that's one of the things we look at is and learn about is when we see this type of injury, we associate that with this type of event.
What does the medical examiner then do at the conclusion of a death investigation?
So the ultimate goal is to complete the information that's needed on the death certificate, specifically the cause and manner of death.
Is a report generated?
Yes.
What's the nature of that report?
Well, one of the main reports that's generated would be considered the autopsy report, and that's the report of the physical examination. But ultimately, the death certificate is kind of the final report.
Now, you told us as a forensic pathologist, you don't treat living patients.
Right.
So if we wanted to have a discussion, for example, about measuring lung volumes or air reserves in someone, well, that wouldn't be your bailiwick as a medical examiner.
That would not be me, no. By the time I see them, none of that applies, yes.
Right. So Dr. Thomas, are you currently employed?
I work, I'm kind of semi-retired. I do consulting, and then I work part-time at medical examiner's offices in Reno, Nevada, and Salt Lake City, Utah.
Reno and Salt Lake City, Dr. Thomas?
There are places. I really like the way the office runs, and I like still to be involved as a medical examiner.
Pretty good places to hike.
And good places to hike, yes.
So what did you, where did you do your work before you were semi-retired?
Right before I retired, I was at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office as an assistant medical examiner. And do you want me to go before that?
Yes, if you could tell us your work experience as a medical examiner forensic pathologist.
Sure. Initially, I started after my training at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office, working as a deputy and assistant, an assistant medical examiner, and I was there for many years. And then in 1997, I joined the Minnesota Regional Medical Examiner's Office that was based in Hastings. And then I was chief of that office for 13 years. And we were the medical examiner's office for 8 counties in Minnesota, the largest of which were Dakota and Scott counties. And we also served as an autopsy referral service and medical examiner's office for many other counties in Minnesota, as well as Wisconsin and even one in Michigan. And then when our office outgrew that space, Dakota and Scott counties merged with Hennepin County, and that's why then I came back to Hennepin County.
So over how many years have you performed work or services as a forensic pathologist?
Let's see, 37 now, 36.
And in Minnesota, how many counties?
Oh, gosh. Well, I've been the direct medical examiner for 8 counties. I've worked in offices that have been consultant to dozens of other counties.
And have you also performed those services in parts of Wisconsin?
Yes.
When did you stop working at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office?
It was early 2017. I retired from Hennepin County.
And how many autopsies would you estimate you have performed over your career?
Probably about 5,000 that I myself did, and then hundreds, maybe 1,000 more where I assisted someone else or I supervised or I participated in some way.
So in 5,000 or so cases, you've determined the cause and manner of death?
Well, actually way more than that, because as medical examiners, we don't just certify the cause and manner of death for the cases that we do autopsies on. There are numerous other cases that get reported by law to the medical examiner's office where we don't do a physical examination. So, for example, an elderly person falls in a nursing home and gets a hip fracture and then dies a couple months later, that death has to be reported to the medical examiner's office. We will investigate that death by looking at the medical records and doing all of what I talked about, getting family input and medical provider input, but we generally will not do a physical examination, but still, by law, we have to sign the death certificate.
So you're still determining then the cause and manner of death?
Right. We're just not using an physical examination as part of it.
And using the medical records primarily?
Yes.
Dr. Thomas, are you licensed presently?
Yes, I'm licensed in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Tennessee, Nevada, and Utah.
Do you also hold any board certifications?
Yes, I'm board certified by the American Board of Pathology in anatomic pathology, clinical pathology, and forensic pathology.
Have you worked with any professional organizations over the years related to forensic pathology?
Yes, I've been a member of many different organizations. Minnesota Medical Association, American Medical Association, College of American Pathologists, American Academy of Forensic Sciences, and then I've been on the board of the Minnesota Coroners and Medical Examiners Association, probably 30 plus years. And then I'm a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners, and I was on that board and a member of their executive committee for a number of years.
And that goes by the acronym NAME, N-A-M-E?
Yes.
What does NAME do?
Well, they're the professional organization of medical legal death investigators, specifically forensic pathologists, medical examiners. And as an organization, they provide support to medical examiners. They provide information. They provide guidelines, an accreditation program, an inspection program, lots of ways of assisting medical examiner offices.
Dr. Thomas, have you done any teaching?
Yes.
I
have been a clinical instructor here at the University of Minnesota Department of Pathology. I've done lots of law enforcement training through the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension here in Minnesota, as well as, oh my gosh, teaching everything from, you know, middle school science students through high school and college and all kinds of professional groups, whether it's other forensic pathologists, other law enforcement, you know, you name the organization that comes into contact with death investigation, and I've probably talked to some of them at some point.
Do you have any publications?
That hasn't been a main focus of my career, but I have several, and early on was involved in an autopsy protocol that was ultimately published by the United Nations that's still in use.
So let's switch topics and talk about your experience testifying in courts. Have you testified before in a court?
Yes, probably over 100 times.
And is that predominantly in your role as a medical examiner?
It's mostly in my role as a medical examiner, where I did the autopsy and then the prosecution would call me to testify as to my findings. I've also testified as an expert witness consultant in cases where I didn't do the autopsy, but I was called by maybe in a civil case, but either by the defense or the plaintiff, if they thought there was a wrongful death or some question about medical malpractice, something like that. And then I've also been consulted and testified in cases at the request of the defense, again, not where I did the autopsy, but where I reviewed someone else's work, and then I consulted with the defense or testified.
And have you testified in Minnesota courts?
Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Pennsylvania. I think those are the ones.
So Dr. Thomas, are you being paid for your time and services in this case?
No.
Could you tell us about that? How does it come about that you're not being paid for your time and services in this case?
Well, I didn't ask to be paid.
And so did you reach out to the state, or did the state reach out to you?
No, you reached out to me. And, you know, I knew this was going to be important, and I felt like I had something to offer, and I wanted to do what I could to help explain what I think happened.
So what were you asked to do then in this case?
Well, I was asked to review a lot of the materials and come to an independent conclusion about what I thought the cause and manner of death were and the mechanism for that cause.
Could you give the jurors a general sense or overview of the kinds of materials you reviewed?
May I look at my notes?
Yes, if you need to refresh your recollection.
So I looked at the Hennepin County Medical Examiner materials, including the autopsy report and toxicology and photographs and microscopic slides, things like that. I looked at the Hennepin County Medical Center records, so Mr. Floyd's past medical history from there, as well as Health Partners medical records. Then I looked at a lot of interviews, many, many videos, including body-worn camera videos, bystander videos, surveillance videos, some photographs, still photographs, timeline, and then some medical literature and textbooks.
So were you the medical examiner who investigated or did the autopsy around the death of George Floyd?
No, that was the Dr. Andrew Baker, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner.
Do you know Dr. Baker?
I do. He was a pathology resident when I was on staff at Hennepin County many years ago. And then when he did his fellowship, I was one of the staff people there. And then after our offices merged, I worked again with him at Hennepin County.
So would it, you have been then part of his training in his early formative years?
Yes.
Do you consider him a friend?
I do, yes.
Have you talked to him about this case?
No, not since right after it happened.
But you did review his report?
Yes.
And as well as Mr. Floyd's medical records?
Yes.
Did you review the history of terminal events for May 25th, 2020?
Yes. What was kind of unique, what was absolutely unique in this case was the volume of materials I had to review. I've never had a case like this that had such thorough documentation of the terminal events.
And by way of the thorough documentation, what makes it so thorough, in your opinion?
Well, the use of videos is unique in this case. Certainly, as medical examiners, we use videos, but there's never been a case that I've been involved with that had videos over such a long time frame and from so many different perspectives.
Are you aware then of Dr. Baker's conclusions then on the manner of death?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd like to show Exhibit 193 that's been stipulated to subject to Dr. Baker's foundation. So first, Dr. Thomas, what do we see here on Exhibit 193?
This is a copy of the certificate of death of Mr. Floyd.
Okay. And so, Brett, if we could kind of highlight just through the word underlying. Just to make it a little bigger to see. Okay. Based on your review of the of the evidence and the death certificate, do you agree with Dr. Baker's determination on the cause of death?
Yes, I do.
And is that by the word immediate on here?
Yes, cardiopulmonary arrest complicating law enforcement, subdual restraint, and neck compression.
Have you, Dr. Thomas, formed an opinion about the mechanism of death?
Yes.
Would you tell us what that is?
In this case, I believe the primary mechanism of death is asphyxia or low oxygen.
So we'll come back to the mechanism in just a minute. Can you explain to the jury what this cause of death means and why you agree with it?
Well, it's kind of in two parts. So there's the cardiopulmonary arrest, which doesn't provide a lot of additional clarifying information because, in a way, everyone dies of when your heart stops and your lungs stop. That's cardiopulmonary arrest. But as a forensic pathologist, I would use cardiopulmonary arrest when I'm to differentiate it from a cardiac arrest. So this is not a sudden cardiac death, a sudden cardiac arrhythmia. This is a death where both the heart and lungs stopped working. And the point is that it's due to law enforcement subdual restraint and compression. That is kind of what ultimately is the immediate cause of death, is the subdual restraint and compression.
And just so it's clear for the jurors, does cardiopulmonary arrest mean heart attack?
No.
Does it mean fatal arrhythmia as a primary cause of death?
No.
It simply means that the heart stops and the lungs have stopped.
Correct.
It's another way of simply describing death itself.
Right.
Can you explain what's referred to, looking here at the terms, subdural restraint and neck compression?
Those were activities by the law enforcement agency officers involved. Subdual is subduing someone, trying to restrain them is, in Mr. Floyd's case, involved handcuffing him, his positioning on the ground, the prone position, the people kneeling on him. And the neck compression is the knee on the neck specifically. Additionally, there was some back and other things being compressed by the officers.
So if you put all this together, cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating, law enforcement subdual, restraint, and neck compression, what does that mean?
Well, what it means to me is that the activities of the law enforcement officers resulted in Mr. Floyd's death, and that specifically those activities were the subdual, the restraint, and the neck compression.
And does this then also represent your own conclusion?
Yes.
A conclusion you have reached and an opinion you hold to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Would you tell us what you reviewed in order to reach this conclusion?
All of those things that I mentioned earlier, again, what's sort of unique about this case is that often I would just review the medical examiner case file, and that would provide information about what the cause and manner of death is. But in this case, the autopsy itself didn't tell me the cause and manner of death, and it really required getting all of this other additional information, specifically the video evidence of the terminal events, to conclude the cause of death and manner of death.
When you make reference to something called the mechanism of death, yeah, would you tell us what mechanism of death means?
So, cause of death is what's the thing, the disease or the injury or the process that caused someone's death. But the mechanism is kind of what was going on in the body at that time. So, for example, the cause of death might be a gunshot wound, but the mechanism of death might be blood loss related to that gunshot wound, or an infection that complicated that gunshot wound down the road, something like that. So it's more the what was actually happening at the body level that resulted in the cause of death.
So focusing in on the mechanism of death here, how is it that the officers of dual restraint and neck compression caused Mr. Floyd's death?
So as I mentioned, I think the primary mechanism was asphyxia or low oxygen. And it basically is Mr. Floyd was in a position because of the subdural restraint and compression where he was unable to get enough oxygen in to maintain his body functions.
What's required for normal breathing, Dr. Thomas?
What is required? Well, there are kind of three components. You have to be able to get air in. So you have to have what's called a patent airway, and that could be nose, mouth, soft tissues of the neck, the larynx, the trachea, the larynx, trachea, bronchi, all of that has to be open. At the level of the lungs itself, there has to be adequate air exchange between oxygen coming in, carbon dioxide going out. And then finally, the way the lungs work is it's kind of like a bellows, that when you suck in air, your diaphragm drops and pulls air in, and then when you relax, the diaphragm collapses and pushes air out. So all three of those things have to be functioning in order to get adequate oxygen in. So for example, if someone is smothered or strangled, or they inhale a piece of hot dog, or they have pneumonia such that their lungs are completely filled, then their airway is obstructed so that there isn't adequate air coming in, oxygen coming in. Or if someone is in an environment where there isn't enough oxygen. So, for example, in a closed garage in which an old car has been running, there may be way high carbon monoxide. And in that case, they're perfectly able to breathe in and out, but there just isn't enough oxygen. And then the third would be if there's some kind of restriction such that your chest can't expand, your diaphragm can't expand, so the bellows function isn't working. And if any one of those components isn't working, then the result will be this mechanism of inadequate oxygen.
Doctor, how does narrowing of the hypopharynx fit into this?
Well, the example I would give that people are probably most familiar with is sleep apnea or snoring. If you yourself or have a partner who snores, you know that especially in certain positions, what happens is the hypopharynx, which is sort of the soft tissues at the back of your throat, will kind of collapse because there's inadequate air coming, either forcing it out or forcing it in, which is why a CPAP machine works, because it forces air through that floppy area. And if that collapses, then it makes it difficult to get air in.
So, Dr. Thomas, what do you rely on to reach your conclusion that low oxygen was the mechanism of death?
In this case, it was primarily the evidence from the terminal events, the video evidence, that show Mr. Floyd in a position where he was unable to adequately breathe.
So how does the autopsy report itself assist you or not?
So the way the autopsy really helps is it's great for ruling things out. So in this case, the autopsy ruled out, for example, underlying lung disease. Mr. Floyd had had a history of COVID, but there was no evidence in his lungs at the time of his death that he had any lung disease that would impair his ability to breathe. And it ruled out injuries to the neck that suggest that the bones in his neck had been broken, for example. And it ruled out a stroke. He didn't have a stroke, so it wasn't like his blood pressure was so high that, you know, he ruptured a vessel in his brain. He didn't have an aneurysm. He didn't have, or which is a ruptured vessel. He didn't have an embolism, which is a blood clot. He didn't rupture his heart. He didn't have an old heart attack or a recent heart attack or what's called myocardial infarct. So the autopsy is really great for ruling things out.
Dr. Thomas, just to focus on one of those, you said the autopsy ruled out a recent myocardial infarction.
Yes.
How does it do that?
Well, when a forensic pathologist examines a heart, one of the things they look at is the coronary arteries, which are the vessels that supply blood and nutrients to the heart muscle. And then the pathologist will examine the muscle of the heart. And if someone has had a recent heart attack, there may be evidence in the heart muscle of that damage. Or if they've had a prior and older heart attack, there will be scarring in the heart muscle that shows that area of damage.
Thank you, Doctor. Is it normal as a part of your death investigation then to seek out and to look at the video?
Yes. Oh, yes.
In this case, is there any particular video footage that struck you as more significant than others from what you saw?
Oh, gosh. This case, there were so many. The body-worn camera videos were very instructive because they started, well, and the Cup Foods video, because they showed how Mr. Floyd was behaving long before law enforcement interaction. Then the body-worn cameras show the early interactions before there was any of this subdual restraint and compression. And then they show the interactions during the subdual restraint. The bystander videos are really instructive, as well as the surveillance videos from the scene, at showing kind of during the time of the restraint. So there were lots, I would say.
So in terms of the video footage then either ruling in a cause or ruling out a cause, how did it inform your assessments about the cause of death, having looked at the video?
Well, it helped me rule in a cause and also rule out causes, I would say.
So did it help you determine whether this was what I might refer to as a lights out kind of death, a sudden death?
Right. So what I observed from all of these videos is this was not a sudden death. Mr. Floyd did not, it's not like the snow shoveling where I told you somebody comes in, collapses, and, you know, clutches their chest and falls over. This was, there was nothing sudden about his death. So that's what I would have expected if it was a cardiac arrhythmia or abnormal beating of the heart. Typically, those are someone really falls over pretty quickly. And this was not that. Likewise, it was not the type of death that has been reported in a fentanyl overdose, for example, where someone becomes very sleepy and then just sort of gradually, calmly, peacefully stops breathing. This was not that kind of a death. So I felt comfortable ruling out those as causes of death. And then on the flip side, I could clearly see from watching the video what happens to Mr. Floyd during this subdual restraint and compression, and what happens to his breathing is it gradually becomes more difficult and then stops.
Doctor, tell us, what is the bellows function?
Well, it's what your diaphragm does along with the muscles in between your ribs. So when you take in a deep breath, what's happening is your rib cage is expanding, and that then forces the lungs to open up, and that's what draws air in. So it's when someone is intubated in like surgery or something, it's sort of the opposite of that, because your diaphragm is paralyzed, and so somebody has to force air in. But under normal breathing circumstances, it's the bellows, it's the pulling air in.
So what did the video tell you? What did you see in it that had to do with the bellows function?
Right. Well, Mr. Floyd is in a position, so first of all, he's prone or sort of slightly with his head to the side, and he has his arms handcuffed behind his back. So that's already a bit of a difficult position to be in, the prone and handcuffed. And then with, at times, at least three officers on top of him, whether it's his neck or his back or his lower back or legs, it prevents him from moving his body into a position where he can adequately use the bellows function. And his chest is sort of compressed in this position in such a way that he can't adequately expand and get enough oxygen in.
Over what period of time was this?
9 minutes.
So what did you see in those 9 minutes that led you to conclude that the mechanism of death was low oxygen or asphyxia?
Well, initially, Mr. Floyd is able to struggle pretty vigorously when he's in this position that he recognizes as it's going to be hard for him to breathe in this position.
So, Steve, that last part of the answer about Mr. Floyd's state of mind is strictly as speculative.
So initially, when he's in the prone position, he's breathing and speaking, and it might look like, oh, he's at that point getting enough air exchange. But over time, you can see that his breathing is getting more and more difficult, and he's saying less and less. And then about halfway through the whole restraint, subdual, compression process, he stops breathing. Well, he first stops speaking entirely. And then again, shortly after that, there's a movement that I believe is what's called an anoxic brain reaction, which is, it looks like kind of a twitch. It's something that the body does when the brain no longer has enough oxygen. So that's the point at which you can tell by looking, oh, that's where he no longer is getting enough oxygen to his brain. And then the restraint and subdual and compression continue for many minutes more, even after someone checks and says, oh, there's no pulse. They maintain the position. So at that point, his heart has also stopped. So he's stopped breathing and his heart has stopped.
So doctor, you mentioned an anoxic, A-N-O-X-I-C.
Yes.
Anoxic brain reaction.
Yes.
Is that also known as an anoxic seizure?
Yes.
Is that something that a person does consciously and voluntarily?
Oh, no. No, it's something that your body just does when your brain doesn't have enough oxygen. It's why in lots of cases, people who are witnessing someone die will say, oh, they had a seizure and died. Well, no, what's actually happened is they've basically died. Their brain doesn't have enough oxygen, and then they had this muscle twitch that may look like a seizure.
So can we go back to Exhibit 193, and I want to ask you about... that's right in front of you. The other contributing conditions, if we could highlight that. All right. So do you see where I'm referring to the other contributing conditions?
Yes.
And what are those?
In this case, they are arteriosclerotic and hypertensive heart disease, fentanyl intoxication, and recent methamphetamine use.
So would you explain for the jury, what does it mean, other contributing conditions?
So the way forensic pathologists and medical examiners usually use this is people often think of it, the death certificate is for that person, that specific person who died and their family. And that's true. It does serve a very useful purpose for life insurance, whatever. But forensic pathologists are also using death certificates for public health data purposes. And so in any given case, we aren't just thinking about this particular person and their cause and manner of death. We're also thinking the state and the federal government collect data on why do people die? What is cause of death? It's how we know as a country that we have, how many people die of COVID, for example. It's because death certificates list that. So one of the things that we use this other contributing conditions for is to list disease processes or drugs that are present at the time of death, but that we don't believe directly contributed to the cause of death. But it's so that someone looking at data years from now can say, okay, we want to do an evaluation of all deaths during law enforcement subdual. And how many of those deaths involved someone who also had drugs on board? Because that may be something that is relevant then in trying to prevent these sort of deaths in the future, for example. Or the case where I use other contributing conditions probably the most is the hip fracture case that I talked about before, where someone dies of a hip fracture due to a fall, but they're 84 years old and they also have hypertensive heart disease, arteriosclerotic heart disease, asthma, diabetes. And so I will list those as other contributing conditions. Now, in no way did those things caused the fall and the hip fracture and the resulting whatever pneumonia or whatever. But again, someone from a data perspective might want to know, you know, of the 84-year-old women who die of hip fractures, what percentage of them have underlying heart disease? Because again, from a data collection standpoint, does that provide useful public health information that can be used in the future to try and prevent these deaths? So that's how I would view this. It's very long-winded, sorry.
Sure, no, Dr. Thomas. So in understanding this is further, so other contributing conditions are conditions that may have contributed but were not the direct cause of the death.
Exactly.
Did you consider these other contributing conditions in your assessment of the cause and mechanism of death for George Floyd?
Yes.
And how did you consider them, first of all?
Well, I wanted to look at each one as and ask the question, is this the cause of his death? Is arteriosclerotic heart disease the cause of his death? He has narrowing of his coronary arteries. In many cases, that is the cause of someone's death. So I looked at that, but again, it comes down to what were the history of the terminal events? Does this look like the type of death we see, or is there, you know, I'm not a clinician, so I don't see it, but as a forensic pathologist, I know from hundreds of families describing what happened at the time of death, that this death does not fit what has been described in someone who dies of a cardiac arrhythmia from arteriosclerotic heart disease. And likewise, hypertensive heart disease. Those tend to be cardiac arrhythmias, sudden cardiac deaths. This is not that kind of death. Likewise, fentanyl intoxication, as I described, and again, I don't treat patients, I don't see living people, but what I know from family members who describe deaths that then later turn out to be due to fentanyl, the death is slow, it's peaceful, they fall asleep, they may hear snoring or very heavy, deep breathing. There's no struggle. They just often are found just kind of slumped over. It's a very slow death. So again, totally different than what is seen in Mr. Floyd's death. Methamphetamine as a cause of death generally is, again, much more of a sudden death. It may cause a cardiac arrhythmia. It may cause a seizure. And by that, I don't just mean this sort of terminal anoxic twitch, but like a full-blown seizure. And again, looking from what I know about Mr. Floyd's death, because it's so well documented, that does not fit with a methamphetamine death.
So you reviewed the toxicology?
Yes, oh yes.
How would you characterize the amount of meth in Mr. Floyd's system at the time?
Well, it was there. It's not particularly high. Certainly in deaths that I have attributed to methamphetamine, it's been much higher. But it's not like there's any safe level of methamphetamine, but this was a very low level.
So was the methamphetamine significant in your assessment of the cause of death?
No.
So then based on your review of the video and application of your work experience and knowledge, did you rule out drug overdose as a cause of death?
Yes.
And that's an opinion you hold to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Now, I wanted to clarify this early and just forgot to. Does the medical examiner also complete the death certificate?
Yes. We don't issue it. That comes from the county or state. But as a medical examiner, we fill out all of the cause and manner and how injury occurred and all that kind of stuff.
How many death certificates have you filled out?
Oh, gosh. Well, thousands and thousands.
So if we look here again at the exhibit in front of you, 193, in the left margin, we see a reference here to underline.
Yes.
Would you tell the jurors what that means?
Sure. So let's go back to that hip fracture, because I keep referring to that. But for example, someone who dies of a hip fracture, generally that's not a sudden death. What happens is someone gets a hip fracture, they get it surgically repaired, they may get pneumonia or something like that. So then, in that kind of case, we would list the immediate cause of death as pneumonia. The underlying cause of that is the hip fracture that was operated, but the underlying cause of the hip fracture was the fall. They fell, they got a hip fracture, they got pneumonia. So it's something that is used when you have a death that has maybe multiple sequences of events. But in a case like this, you don't need an underlying because it's all included in the first line. It's all due to the law enforcement subdural restraint and neck compression.
Now, the death certificate does not use the word asphyxia or any reference to low oxygen.
No.
Would you have used the word asphyxia in this case?
Probably not. I tend not to use the word asphyxia much because it requires a lot of explanation. It doesn't really offer much additional information unless you have a chance to have a discussion like we've had about what asphyxia means. So I tend to just list, you know, if someone dies of hanging, well, that's a type of asphyxial death. But I wouldn't say necessarily asphyxia due to hanging. I would probably just list hanging as the cause of death.
So to refer to asphyxia or low oxygen doesn't tell you anything about why there is asphyxia or low oxygen.
Right.
Are the findings on autopsy that suggest low oxygen as a cause of death?
No, there's nothing on autopsy that shows low oxygen.
There's no test that could be done for low oxygen on autopsy?
No.
Are there physical findings that sometimes may be found and may be consistent with low oxygen?
So there are no physical findings that show low oxygen, but there may be physical findings that are consistent with a cause of death that may result in low oxygen. So, for example, the hanging, let's use that hanging. If someone is partially hanged, by that I mean they are only partially suspended, so there's only some pressure on their neck, they may have what are called petechiae or little pinpoint hemorrhages in the eyes because blood is still going into their head but not able to drain out because of the pressure on the neck. So at autopsy, we will see the petechiae and we can say, based on the scene investigation and the history, that finding is consistent with hanging, which the mechanism for hanging is a type of asphyxia. Or in manual strangulation, we might see some bruising, or we might see broken bones in the neck. And the mechanism of death in strangulation is low oxygen, but the finding that we are seeing is consistent with strangulation. So it's kind of a fine line between saying it isn't the low oxygen that we see at autopsy, but sometimes, not always, but sometimes in cases where the death is the result of low oxygen, we see specific findings related to the cause.
So if you then see petechiae, it could help to lead you to the conclusion that it was death by low oxygen.
Yes.
But if you don't see petechiae, what can you conclude?
Nothing. So it's one of those things that when it's present, if there's petechiae or broken bones in the neck or bruising, that's very helpful in putting together a picture of what might have happened. But if you don't have them, it doesn't help you one way or the other.
And by not help you one way or the other, it means you can't conclude from that alone that a person did or did not die of low oxygen.
Exactly.
And you mentioned bruising in that context.
Right. And again, sometimes, I mean, for example, strangulation is a great example. Sometimes in strangulation, you have all kinds of bruises that you can see on the neck, But other times there's a strangulation case and they don't have a single mark on their neck. And I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that bruises may or may not occur, but it's, again, it's one of those things. If it's there, it's very helpful. If it's not, it's not helpful.
Were there other findings in the death investigation that supported your conclusion on the cause and mechanism of George Floyd's death?
Yes.
Would you tell us what those were?
So Mr. Floyd had superficial injuries, what would be described as superficial injuries, specifically on his face, on his shoulders, on his wrists. And what that does is it supports what I saw in the videos, which is that he's being forcibly restrained and subdued, and he's trying to move into a position by rubbing his face against the concrete cement of the ground, by pulling against his handcuffs. You can see the injury to his wrists from the handcuffs, and by pushing with his shoulder. And he also had some scrapes on his knuckles on his right hand. And again, that was from him pushing to try and get into a position where he could breathe.
Dr. Thomas, are there photographs that depict what you're describing?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
So, Your Honor, we've stipulated by way of foundation to the photos, we have individual packets for the jurors.
Members of the jury, there's some stipulated photographs that are going to be shown to you, or as we call, as you've heard me say, published to you. We're going to go old school this time. We're not going to put everything on the monitors. We're not going to broadcast it out. But everybody in the courtroom will have access to it, including yourselves. Essentially, a packet with these photographs. We'll collect them afterwards because these are for you to use in the courtroom. The actual exhibit will be available in deliberation, however. Mr. Blackwell?
Yeah, would you either like the deputy or someone distribute these, or should I not?
You can go ahead, Mr. Blackwell.
We were there when the 1918 flu pandemic hit. We have been by your side through every second of the COVID-19 fight. Whatever happens.
Don't start looking through them until Mr. Blackwell resumes his examination. Mr. Blackwell, Mr. Schaefer will take care of the rest. Sure, everybody who would like a copy gets one. Spectators. Spectators should each get a copy if they want one. You'll have to give up one of your copies. There you go. Mr. Blackwell?
Your Honor, if I may, I think I'll give one to Dr. Thomas just so she has it.
Actually, she can have mine.
That way, Your Honor, we'll have to use the camera more. So, Dr. Thomas, if we start with the exhibit that's marked 185.
Yes.
I take that back. I would like to see it on my screen. Dr. Thomas, looking at Exhibit 185, what is significant in this photograph that informs your conclusions pertaining to the restraint and subdual as a cause of Mr. Floyd's death?
This is a photograph of Mr. Floyd's face, and it shows some facial injuries, most notably the what are called abrasions, which are scrapes over his left eyebrow and over his left cheek. You can also see there's littler scrapes or small cuts on his nose and lip, upper lip, and then a little on the left side of his lower lip. But the main thing this shows is that the left side of his face was obviously in contact with some rough surface.
Dr. Thomas, if we look at Exhibit 235, it may be a close-up of the same area.
Sorry. Here we go. Yes. Yes, that is a close-up of the left cheek and the left forehead. And you can see, for example, above the left eyebrow, there's a dark area that's a dried scrape, as well as there's a little bit of discoloration of the skin, so that also there was a bruise there. And then on his left cheek, you can see the dark area as well as kind of a lighter orange pink area, and those are, again, scrapes. The dark area is where a scrape has dried.
And what does that tell you about the cause or mechanism of his death?
It's consistent with the impression from watching the video that his face was on the ground and he was moving his face in an effort to get into a position where he could breathe.
Let's look at Exhibit 188.
This is a photograph of Mr. Floyd's left shoulder.
What did we see here?
This, again, is an area of scrapes and indicates that there was some force between his shoulder and some rough surface, in this case, the ground. And again, is consistent with what it looks like on the video, that he's struggling to push himself into a position where he can breathe.
Let's look at Exhibit 187.
This is a photograph of his right shoulder. And again, you can see there's a little bit of discoloration, and then the skin is scraped. So there's less injury impact here, and that fits with, again, what you see in the video of which side was down and which side had more contact with the ground.
Let's look at Exhibit 189.
This is a photograph of Mr. Floyd's left hand. And if you look at the base of his hand, sort of right over his wrist, you can see there's some areas of red discoloration with kind of a pale area in between. And that's consistent with handcuff marks. You can also see on the sort of outer edge, there's some white material that's dried skin. And that's an area where his skin has actually been rubbed up from the handcuffs.
And Dr. Exhibit 190?
Exhibit 190 is a photograph of his right hand and wrist. And again, in this case, you can see more clearly the sort of the double-lined discoloration above his right wrist. That's consistent with the handcuff marks and indicates pressure against handcuffs. And again, on the outer edge, you can see there's a little bit where it's darker and then there's some white skin. So that's an area where it's actually been scraped. The skin has actually been scraped by the handcuffs. Also, on this photograph, you can see on the knuckles of his index finger and middle finger, there's some skin that is scraped off. And that's consistent with what you can see on the video where he's pushing against, I think it's the rim of the car tire or something, to try and push his body into a position again where he can breathe.
Thank you, Dr. Thomas. Your Honor, the jurors may put the photographs away if they like.
Not the actual exhibits, they're simply for your use during this time. And we'll ask the spectators also to return the exhibits. You can keep yours. Counsel can keep theirs.
Thank you, Your Honor. So Dr. Thomas, having looked at this physical evidence from the autopsy, was that evidence in of and by itself conclusive?
No. There are multiple ways that scrapes and bruises can happen. It's only useful in the context of what is seen in the videos.
Was there any evidence to suggest that Mr. Floyd was suffering from a potentially fatal condition on the evening of May 25th, 2020?
No.
Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty if Mr. Floyd would have died that night had he not been subject to the subdual and restraint of the police?
There's no evidence to suggest he would have died that night, except for the interactions with law enforcement.
Now, were there other mechanisms that you felt contributed to Mr. Floyd's death?
Yes.
Could you generally characterize what those were?
Sure. So I think a secondary mechanism in this case is what I refer to as physiologic stress. And by that, I don't mean like the stress, oh, somebody's a type A personality and they have a deadline at work and they're just really stressed about it. I'm not talking about that kind of stress. I'm talking about the kind of physical stress you feel when you're driving along and all of a sudden a car swerves right in front of you and you slam on the brakes and you realize, oh my gosh, if I hadn't reacted, if that had happened a second earlier, I would have been in a potentially fatal car crash. And you can feel your heart race and and then the car speeds on and you slow down and you realize I'm okay. Everybody in the car is okay. And, you know, your heart rate then slows. Or I think even worse, you're at the beach and you suddenly realize my toddler. I haven't seen my toddler in oh my gosh, where's my toddler? And that rush of adrenaline you get and you feel flushed and you get goosebumps and your heart races and you feel short of breath. And then there they are, they're getting an ice cream cone and you'd go, oh, okay. But it takes you a minute for your heart to kind of slow down and your blood pressure to slow down and you to be able to take a deep breath and recover yourself. So that's the kind of physiologic stress I'm talking about, only instead of after a second or a minute, this goes on for minute after minute after minute for 9 minutes, where you are terrified and you can't, there's no recovery. So it's that kind of fear of life that I'm talking about for physiologic stress.
Are you able to tell us what is going on in the body during the physiologic stress?
So it's The reactions are you get chemical release, you get adrenaline, noradrenaline, or epinephrine, norepinephrine, and those are things that make your heart race, your blood pressure go up, you require more, your muscles get ready to act, to go run, to do whatever you need to do, slam on the brakes, and so you start needing more oxygen in your muscles, you need to take more breaths, you need more oxygen for your heart rate, because your heart's beating faster. There may be other chemicals that are released, whether it's stress hormones or cortisol or things like that. There may be lactic acid that's produced as your muscles, when you have a heavy workout, your muscles get tired and kind of sore. It's because there's been an increase in lactic acid and it's your muscles working. So all of those physical things, those chemical things, can cause reactions in the body that put additional stress primarily on your heart, but also on all of your body systems, because your body requires your chemistry to be in very fine balance. And when there's too much, say, lactic acid or too much, not an ability to compensate for that elevated lactic acid, then all of your body organs will get into trouble.
Doctor, do you consider that physiological stress that you're describing a direct cause or mechanism of death, or is it secondary?
Well, I guess I would consider it a contributory cause, or contributory to the cause of death. It's another contributing mechanism.
And so the direct cause is what, and then the secondary cause is what?
So their sort of primary mechanism, I think, is asphyxia, and the secondary, or low oxygen, and the secondary mechanism is this physiologic stress. But ultimately, the cause of death is the subdural restraint and compression.
So this physiologic stress, or physiological stress, that we're discussing, is that something that can be observed on autopsy?
No.
And why is that?
Well, it's a chemical reaction. It's increased heart rate, which of course we don't see at autopsy. It's increased chemicals that we can't test for at autopsy. So none of it is anything that can be seen physically.
So it's a functional mechanism.
Yes, that's a good way of describing it.
Is low oxygen then also a functional mechanism?
Yes.
So could you tell us how you felt that the physiological stress was significant to your conclusion on the cause of Mr. Floyd's death?
So Mr. Floyd was already in a position where he was experiencing difficulty breathing and getting enough oxygen in his body. And on top of that now, there's this physiologic stress that's putting increased demand on his heart, increased demand on his lungs, increased demand on his muscles. So all of the things that he's using, his muscles, his strength, his body, to try and get himself into a safe position where he can breathe, those are being doubly stressed by the position that he's in, as well as the underlying chemical reactions that are going on in his body. So it's kind of a double whammy to his heart and lungs and muscles and his whole system.
So, Dr. Thomas, I want to show you Exhibit 194. Again, Your Honor, that's been stipulated to, subject to foundation later. First, Dr. Thomas, can you tell us what this is?
This is a press release that was put out by the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office at the time they certified the cause and manner of death of Mr. Floyd.
And is it your understanding that the Medical Examiner's Office generates this type of a press release report in certain cases?
Yes.
So there is a section in the press release report that refers to manner of death?
Yes.
Let's see if we can highlight that. And we see the word there, homicide.
Yes.
We see also in here information we saw on the death certificate where the press release says also how the injury occurred.
Yes.
And would you read that for the record?
How injury occurred, decedent experienced a cardiopulmonary arrest while being restrained by law enforcement officers.
Again, you agree with that?
Yes.
So let me show you what's was marked as Exhibit 918. And homicide is a manner of death.
Yes.
Would you explain to the jurors a little bit about what it is medical examiners look to when they're trying to determine manner of death?
Sure. So unlike cause of death, which could be anything, we only have five options for manner of death. So a death can be natural, meaning that all of the conditions that contribute to the death are due to just innate processes. Could be cancer, could be heart disease, something like that. Second category is an accident, and that would be something like a motor vehicle crash or an unintended drug overdose. Third category is a suicide, which is death at one's own hands, with at least probably some element of intent. The fourth category is homicide, and that means death at the hands of another. And then the fifth category is undetermined, and that means generally we don't have enough information about this type of death to make a determination to fit it into one of the other categories. So, for example, we talked a lot about terminal events early on, and in some cases we have no idea what the terminal events were because the person is just found dead in their residence. And we don't know, because they've been alienated from family, we don't know, were they saying they were going to take their lives? Did they have a prolonged history of using drugs? Did they just get out of prison? You know, we're unable to get enough information to sort it into, was this an accidental death or was this an intentional suicide death? And so that would be an example where we might use undetermined, where we just don't have enough information.
So, Dr. Thomas, if you look then at the screen in front of you, does this depict or show the manners of death?
Exactly.
And homicide is highlighted, reflecting what Dr. Baker found.
Yes.
And do you agree with that finding?
Yes.
In the case of George Floyd. Your Honor, we offer Exhibit 918.
Any objection? And the exhibit itself is without the highlight, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Item 18 is received.
For the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, these are the five manners of death that you were describing, Dr. Thomas?
Yes.
And we've highlighted homicide to reflect what Dr. Baker found and that you agree with.
Yes.
Is there any guidance given to medical examiners about how to select homicide as a manner of death?
Yes. There is a guide that was published by the National Association of Medical Examiners that provides assistance in how to make a determination between these different.
I want to show you what's been marked as Exhibit 952. You see that, Dr. Thomas?
Yes, yes.
And is this the publication that provides the guidance to medical examiners on how to determine manner of death?
Yes.
Would reference to excerpts from this guide be helpful to your testimony?
Yes.
Your Honor, we offer excerpts from Exhibit 952.
Any objection?
Yes, I do object to this.
All right. Actually, would this be a good time to break so we can deal with the sidebar issue as well? All right, members of the jury, we'll take our 20-minute. We're probably going to have some work here, so let's come back around 5 after, 11:05.
This particular exhibit, I don't think it's appropriate for this to be admitted as an actual exhibit because it contains a medical definition of what constitutes homicide. The jury, it's within the province of the jury in terms of the jury instructions that are ultimately provided to them to determine the legal definition.